This edition of the Monocle Weekly was first broadcast on the 20th of January 2013 on Monocle 24. The Monocle Weekly is brought to you in association with Tourism Australia. Hello and welcome to the Monocle Weekly, episode 185, with me, Robert Bounds, and Andrew Tuck.
On today's show, we'll be meeting Marco Roth, the co-founder of N Plus One Literary Journal, and his new book explores how HIV and AIDS affected growing up in early 1980s New York.
And we'll be looking at the UK's role in Europe's future, asking Berlin-based journalist and author David Charter, is there a future at all?
And we'll also be discussing the London Art Fair and the creative outlook for 2013. There's still time to nip down to the fair for a bargain today, but we've had its director, Jonathan Burton, come to us instead.
All that, plus we'll find out how to create the perfect railway with design historian Mark Ovenden. Tom Edwards will be here with the news agenda, and there might be time for a tune too right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. Only three shows back, Andrew, and already you've come in with the words, I've just had 1 minute lunch.
I think I may be in the Guinness Book of Records for eating I think it was called Thai chowder. I've eaten a Thai chowder soup in 1 minute.
Thai chowder sounds like a euphemism for something. It sounds like...
Drank too much last night. I had a bit of a Thai chowder when I got
Thai
home.
Thai chowder. I know, it sounds...
Sounds wrong.
Sounds terribly wrong. Thank goodness you're here, though. Thank God you did manage to down it in less than a minute. It does sound like a something that Norris McWhirter should judge on, right?
I know it's not very Sunday-ish, but I have a sandwich waiting in the fridge as well.
That's not
a sentence we want to say either,
God.
Is it?
Well, let's review the week. How was yours? You started off in Milan, didn't you? And now you've ended up here. It's gone downhill, basically, for you.
I started with the catwalks of the Milan shows, and I've ended with what would be quite a good book title, A Sandwich in the Fridge. But
A Sandwich in the Fridge.
Yes.
Andrew Tuck's memoirs.
I went with a big posse of Monocle people, which is always nice. I went with Aisha and Barrett came over from New York because they went to Florence for Pitti Uomo to do our report for the next magazine about the selling of menswear there in Florence with Take from our fashion team. They all went down to Milan where I joined them for a kind of a bit of a soiree. As you know, you've been there for that event we do every fashion week. Karina was there from Italy. Kari came from London. It was good. We had a lot of people.
That's a knees up.
And it was quite good being with...
No sandwiches in the fridge in Milan,
with Sophie, Kari and Karina, three of the tallest...
How's that?
Handsomest women around.
She was a handsome woman with a diary of 3,000 a year.
And midget me at the front. It was quite good. It was like, yeah.
I hope there are some pictures. Will they be on a well-known social networking site?
I don't...
I'm going to have a look.
Well, you can
make a
look.
I bet they are. I went to lots of screenings this week. It's the time of year when all the film PRs squeezing all the screenings for the sort of pre-Oscars season. So it's been kind of nice, sort of sitting in... sitting in air-conditioned dark rooms all night. But it is rather a decent, sober start to the year. You see, it's nice.
And have you seen some good things?
I've seen some great things. And I saw Terrence Malick's movie this week, wanting it to be great... But unfortunately, it was like The Tree of Life Part 2, which was a bit of a letdown for kind of lots of critics.
I like a bit of kind of pomposity, and I thought I was going to like Tree of Life. I thought that sounds kind of a bit too much. I'm bound to love that.
Yeah.
And actually, even I was like sitting there after like 10 minutes thinking, oh no, this is a bit tough.
I know, it is. And the new one, it's sad because I love Terrence Malick's earlier stuff. You are just expecting someone just to kind of whisper, Eternity by Calvin Klein. And it reminds me of that great Fry and Laurie. It reminds me of the beginning of the old Fry and Laurie sketches where they had this fake perfume advert and it was between fact and breakfast we bring you. And it's otherwise known as rubbish. That's all the news in our lives. Now it's time to try and figure out other people's... Who do we call on to do that? Not the Ghostbusters.
Tom Edwards.
Tom Edwards, welcome with your news agenda to the Monocle Weekly.
Hi, Rob.
I'm feeling more and more, can I just say this before you kick off, that you should have like a theme tune of your own on this, something like Steptoe and Son or something.
I have mooted that before. So far, it hasn't received any... That idea's not gained traction.
I did sing it to you once. I made up a little jingle for you, but you didn't like it.
I wasn't super into that one, that's true.
What was that?
I'd like something a little more produced. Is that possible?
Was it the theme tune to Deputy Dog?
It was more of a kind of an acapella.
That makes me mad.
See, that would be perfect. I could say that at the end.
Yeah, you could say that at the end. Things you don't like. What Tom doesn't like this week.
Yeah, I'd be willing to
nice.
Allow the segment to turn into
People
that.
Might write in and suggest theme tunes for you, Tom. But in the meantime, you've got to keep coming up with the goods.
Well, let's start then with tomorrow. Only really one place to start, I think, in geopolitical terms, Barack Obama's re-inauguration. Obviously, it's always a big event. One of the things that intrigues me always is how they mark the event sort of behind closed doors when they have the big celebrations. And I know I wanted to ask you in particular about this, Rob, what you think of Barack Obama's lineup for the inauguration ball, amongst others, Beyonce.
I thought Destiny's Child, are they reforming for his inauguration or
for
the Super Bowl?
I think it's just Beyonce.
Just Beyonce, okay.
So, you know, that's probably tough for the other members, but there we are. She's the big ticket item.
Quality control, isn't it, the White House?
Beyonce Knowles, Kelly Clarkson, and folk veteran James Taylor.
Pretty good.
Do you want to know what they're going to be singing between them?
Yeah.
Beyonce will belt out the national anthem. Clarkson will perform My Country, Tis of Thee, and Taylor will perform his rendition of America the Beautiful.
That'd be pretty good.
James,
that's something for everyone, something for all the age ranges. You've got your, sort of Bible Belt satisfied. You've got your urban sprawl sort of settled for there. I think that's a pretty good lineup, right, Andrew?
I don't want to put you on the spot, but is it televised? Do people get to see this, or do they just have to kind of?
I think the highlights. I'm not sure it's broadcast live. I could be incorrect about that, but the highlights are invariably transmitted.
So you get to see Beyonce.
Should do. Shaking her stuff. And just one final note on this. Cuban-American Richard Blanco has been appointed as the inaugural poet this year. At 44, he's the youngest poet, he's the first Hispanic and the first gay writer to take the role.
Everyone will be watching that with absolutely no interest as usual whenever there's something about public poetry then.
Well, I don't know. I wonder whether that might capture, you know, the spirit of Obama. He's trying to be a bit bolder perhaps in the second term. Yeah. Maybe it will be indicative of that.
Performance poetry, that's the
way. I can't think of anything that rhymes with Barrack, and that's quite a tough job, isn't it?
I reckon Richard Blanco will be up to the task.
I reckon he's got... I think the best way to do it would be in limericks. There was a young lady from Tring. Anyway. So that's good. That's going to be good. We're all jealous of Barack tomorrow for having that superstar lineup.
Yeah. Well, talking of stellar lineups, Rob.
Yeah.
On Wednesday, the World Economic Forum. Now, I thought I'd mention this in particular because, of course, Monaco will be broadcasting from the event.
Talking of stellar lineups, Steve Bloomfield's going to go.
Well, absolutely. So Midori House on Wednesday and Thursday of this week, Steve will be bringing us the latest from Davos. And alongside Steve Bloomfield, other luminaries of the international scene will include Angela Merkel, David Cameron, Dmitry Medvedev, for example. Plenty of big names.
Imagine those four in a room. Man, the ego.
Well, I'm sure they'll be searching Steve Bloomfield.
We need to do a kind of footwear watch because apparently it's a bit of a trouble because all these poor men, kind of women, who are used to only kind of wearing very sensible shoes around the office, suddenly they find themselves in knee-deep snow. They don't know whether to put on moon boots with their suit and look a bit weird,
kind
of slip and slide.
What would be your advice, Andrew? As a stylish man,
I think there's some nice boots from like Kandahar. When we were up in Samaritz, I was ogling those nice Kandahar boots. They looked good. They were like a half boot. You could tuck your trouser in, but there was no kind of moonness going on.
Okay. Shall I move on to my?
Let's
third
have the third
and final
one. We've got to squeeze this one in, Tom.
So on Friday, this is deeply serious. It's the anniversary of the Egyptian uprisings. 2 years later, of course, we remember the scenes at Tahrir Square, at the ousting of Hosni Mubarak in 2011. And it'll be interesting to see how this is marked, because obviously there's still a great deal of dissatisfaction, particularly amongst opposition groups. And in fact, some of the key members of the opposition have announced their intention to protest on this anniversary, so it won't necessarily be a particularly happy day. But who knows? Maybe memories of, you know, what was at stake that day will galvanise the opposition, enable them to present more of a kind of coherent challenge to, you know, the Islamists who are currently running the show, not very popular with it.
What day is that happening?
That is on Friday.
So we can look for some hard news analysis from Monocle 24.
Oh, most definitely. For the latest on it,
shows,
both from Cairo and how the ramifications will be held around the world. Friday, tune in to Monocle 24 as ever.
I like it.
God, that was almost seamless.
It was.
Almost.
I feel like we've got three different stories, three different soundtracks. Who knows how Tom's entrance is going to be heralded next week. Tom Edwards, as ever, thank you very much. You are tuned in to the Monocle Weekly. I'm Robert Bannon with Andrew Tuck. New York author Marco Roth will be telling his story in a second.
Our first guest is an author whose enthusiasm for storytelling led him to co-found the much-lauded US literary journal N+1. Now, Marco Roth's debut book, The Scientists, A Family Romance, tells the story that he really knows best. his own.
Roth's comfortable upbringing in an apartment overlooking New York Central Park, raised by a doctor father and a classical musician mother, was one shrouded by his father's contraction of AIDS in the early 1980s. It was a time when the disease was less understood, less accepted, and less treatable than today. Roth's book explores growing up overshadowed by that taboo, and he joins us now in the studio to tell us a little bit more about the book. Marco, welcome to The Weekly.
Thank you.
First of all, we should talk about the genesis of this book and how tough it was to write the first sentence of a book like this. They're difficult for most authors, but how did it start?
Well, it's strange. In your introduction, you said this is the story I know best. And in many ways, it's a story that I realized I didn't know at all. And only when I realized the extent to which I didn't know the real story could I begin to explore telling it. And there had been various versions when I was younger, when I was in graduate school, in my 20s. I tried writing about my father largely in an anti-memoir against a book that his sister, who is a novelist and a memoirist, published when I was 23, in which she suggested that he got AIDS, as she put it, in the more usual way, as opposed to the story that I had grown up with, which is that he got it in the lab in the course of his medical research and was something of a heroic scientist. And she was the first person to kind of put out there this possibility, but she had this reputation in our families. She was the novelist and the storyteller and the fanciful one. And that was really the first time that I began to think, maybe I don't know anything about my family at all. And the first sentence of the book itself, went by the time I came to write the book, was very easy, although there were about 10 versions of it, and then I had to settle on one.
Exactly. And is it? I mean, it's a story that tackles AIDS head on. And when, as we said in the introduction, it was both something that was unknown and a taboo. Is this something that? I mean, how far do you think we've come public in terms of public understanding and your own understanding of your family in terms of that?
Well, I think it varies very much from city to city, even not mm-hmm. even just country to country. I mean, there are parts of America where people don't really want to talk about AIDS. And actually, I came from a very liberal, tolerant, scientific, curious part of America, the Upper West Side of New York City. And yet, it turns out that there are taboos, for instance, on bisexuality or sexual confusion, and that remain very strong. And it was kind of confusing to me to watch my father, who I had always thought of as a very brave man, and he'd worked with torture victims from El Salvador and Argentina as part of his pro bono medical work. And suddenly he was afraid that, and I couldn't tell anybody that he had AIDS, and you know, I couldn't tell my teachers, I couldn't tell my friends, and this was meant to be a secret in our family. And yet he was very open about the way the disease worked. So he kind of turned himself into a scientific subject, and he was part of medical trials. And that was how we dealt with the disease in the family. Is, you know, it was like, oh, well, what's the T-cell count today? And you know, yeah. What's this drug going to do? And that turned into a way of his not talking about the disease, you know, what it was like to know that he was going to die, which he never talked about, or to suspect that, you know, to not know how much time he had, but to know it was very little. So all of that kind of got shoved under the rug. Or, you know, you can say in the closet.
Yeah. Can I ask you, Marco, what was interesting, you talk about this other book that was written about your father. You're now kind of interceding in your family's history again. And in the book, you talk quite a lot about how, in many ways, we don't know the other people who surround us in a family, even probably in the most open of families. There are sides of people we don't see. And you talk about, really intriguingly, about the relationship between your mother and father and the things they did together and separately and what they didn't know about each other and what they chose not to know. Do you think you've told a truth here, or are you very aware this is just another version of the truth, that, you know, that you're surveying a landscape that I imagine everybody who has been part of that story will look in and think, oh, that's kind of true, but, you know, What were you searching for in the telling of this? Did you believe that you could get to any truth?
Yeah, I don't think that there is an absolute truth. I mean, in certain ways, I feel like I'm an accidental postmodernist. And this is also part of what I wanted to write about is, you know, people say that their stuff is all theoretical, but actually this is very much my experience. I mean, postmodernism explains my family better than other theories of and descriptions of reality. What is sexual identity? Is it fluid? What does it mean? You know, when my mother said that she was telling me the truth when she when I questioned her after my aunt's book came out, and she said, "I know what you know," and what she meant by this is, you probably know, but you're not really aware that you know, and I'm not going to tell you. And so for her, that was a version of the truth. And I think that's, I mean, what one really has to do as a memoirist is not claim to be omniscient, but to map the ways that you come across stories that are presented to you as true and come across information and put that information into play and organize it. And it's that to me is the reason to write a memoir. Not because you feel like you're. There are other situations, which was not my situation, where you could have a story that was actively suppressed, but no, there was no story that was actively suppressed. It was just kind of, it was very much in the air and never talked about and yet mentioned indirectly. So in certain ways, I feel like it's a very British story, although coming from America.
I wanted to ask you about that, the idea of the suppression of truths, both known and unknown. Sound like we're getting into Donald Rumsfeld territory.
Oh yeah.
But does your father's scientific mind lend? It sounds like it lent him a certain stoicism. Did that take away from the emotion of it? Did that make it less easy to grieve for the facts?
Yeah, or in a way, we were always grieving for facts and not grieving for emotions. Although emotions are facts, and I think that was. I was kind of brought up in this informational bath where, I could tell you what reverse transcriptase was when I was 12 years old, and then I read about this in the book. And that kind of got in everyone's way as far as recognizing what people were feeling. And then, the other thing that my father used very brilliantly in this was literature, which he loved, and he was a frustrated literary scholar, and who knows, maybe also a writer. I mean, one thing that I found amusing is that my aunt, who's the writer in the family, actually is motivated by what she thinks of as a dogged pursuit of truths, and my father was this incredible artist of the everyday, in which everything seemed to go into how is this going to look or play out, and that was something that I really needed to discover this for myself. And you realize that like the books that you've read that you think are telling you who you are not really about you, and the emotional cues that the books give you are emotional cues not to your life but to somebody else's life, but that's the only access that they're giving you, are these tiny glimpses.
And this sounds like there's a literary critic in here talking. We should mention M+1, the literary journal, because it's tough, right, to write something like this and dissociate the learning from the emotions of it, and your writing from other people's. But maybe tell us a bit about the journal as well, M+1.
Yeah, M+1 was founded in 2004 in Brooklyn with four friends of mine from graduate school and undergraduate, and we were variously dissatisfied with the writing that we could do for established publications, and also we were fed up with Iraq, with the things that nobody was saying about the Iraq War. It was a period in which people were talking already about the death of a certain kind of magazine, magazines we had admired, like The Baffler and Lingua Franca, which was a great journal that covered academic life, had shut down. And people were like, oh, no, you can't really write in a way that's going to mix personal narrative and journalism and literary criticism. And we were like, well, why not? I mean, this, because life is mixed. You read the, just because you're studying literature doesn't mean that you have to distance it from your own experience and from the experience of your age. And we looked back to a period when people were writing essays that were more, that we felt, were full-bodied or multi-generic, and we wanted to revive that. So that was, and we also, we wanted to really show that it's still possible to write this way. And that was the wager that I took in the book as well.
Marco, well, thank you for coming in. The book is The Scientist. Marco Roth is the author. He's the author in the family. There's two. We can say that.
Indeed. Actually, well, there's three. It's very complicated. You will have to read the book.
I fear that it's not going to be the last. Marco Roth, thank you so much for coming in. Hold your horses. We're going to have a song now. This is new from Yola Tengo from their new record called Fade. It's out tomorrow. This is Well You Better. That was Well You Better, new from Yola Tengo, and you're tuned in to the Monocle Weekly with me, Robert Bounds, and Andrew Tuck. We'll be asking what life would be like for the UK sans Europe after this.
Stephen Newland is a seaplane pilot on Queensland's magnificent coastline and is in no doubt that the colourful, dazzling, awe-inspiring Great Barrier Reef is the finest natural wonder in the world.
I'd have to say, especially around this area here, the water and the scenery is just incredible. The Great Barrier Reef just changes every day. It's never the same.
There's nothing like Australia.
In recent weeks, the UK's always cordial yet sometimes non-committal relationship with the EU has again been in the news, with US's diplomatic might weighing in and speculation being rife over David Cameron's next move. Our next guest has been finding out what life might be like if the UK cut its ties and broke away. David Charter is Berlin correspondent for The Times, and his new book, Au Revoir Europe, asks the question that many recent debates have boiled down to: should we stay? Or should we go? He joins us on the line from Berlin. David, welcome to the Monocle Weekly.
Thank you very much.
What does it boil down to then at the end of the day? Is it a money question? Is it good value to be in the EU for the UK?
Well, the answer to that question is we think it's good value, but we don't really know because the government has never done a full cost-benefit analysis. We do know that the single market enables a lot of business to be done that adds to British GDP. But there are other aspects of membership, such as the membership fee we pay, for example, and the impact on food prices of the Common Agricultural Policy, which perhaps are on the negative side of the balance sheet. As I say, though, this has never really been worked out to the last penny, partly because there are so many other intangible, you might say, benefits of being in the European Union. The one that is probably most acclaimed is the one they won the Nobel Peace Prize for, which is keeping the peace in Europe for the last 70 years, which is kind of hard to put a value on, really. So there are when you look at it, there are many tangible and intangible effects that leaving the European Union would certainly have.
And it seems tough to even if a cost benefit analysis were laid out to the British public and to the Europeans as a whole, whether or not they can dissociate that from these ideas of sovereignty and the ideas of the nation. Do you think those ideas of sovereignty have been subsumed a little in countries, certainly like Germany, that obviously leads the charge in Europe?
Yeah, I do think that, because certainly for Germany after the war, it was in no position to be a leading nation in building a new Europe, if you like. They kind of had to go with the flow. So it wasn't so difficult for them to subsume their sovereignty into a bigger organization that included other countries. However, Britain is one of the few countries that, you might say, emerged not unscathed, but victorious, if you like, from the Second World War. Without any loss of sovereignty, never having been invaded, for example. And the idea of sharing, or some would say sacrificing sovereignty for the greater good of Europe, for perhaps a bigger role on the world stage, this idea has never really been embraced by the British people and by British MPs more widely, I think.
Can I ask you, do you think that part of the problem is we're just not really, we've got so used to the benefits of being in the EU. Lots of the things we've taken on board and that help us in our daily lives, that those things, we kind of forget that that's part of being the EU, whether that's the supposedly several hundred thousand Britons who now live in Spain or live in Europe for work and for retirement, you know, whether that's the fact that we can travel around Europe without having to get our passport out. There's lots of things that seem to be clearly obvious benefits being part of this community that nobody ever talks about because, I don't know, we just got used to them.
Yeah, partly we've got used to them and partly we are actually quite ignorant of what some of the benefits have been from the European Union. For example, the likes of EasyJet and Ryanair wouldn't have become the biggest and the second biggest low-cost airlines in Europe if the European Union hadn't existed. I mean, people probably forget that or don't even know that in the 1970s there really were only national airlines that had stitched up all the flight paths between them, and the prices, it was really quite expensive to fly around Europe. And if Britain was not in Europe, or if it left, it would be an absolute priority to negotiate membership of what they call the Single European Sky, which is an organization that all European Union countries belong to, and it actually enables EasyJet to fly between European cities. There probably would be no problem flying from the UK to a European destination if we left the EU, although that is, again, slightly questionable. But EasyJet certainly wouldn't be able to fly from, say, Dublin to Turin, off the top of my head as an example, because you can only do that if you're a member of the European Union and the Single European Sky.
And I wanted to know, as a newspaper man yourself, David, what part the media has to play in the education and the ignorance of Britons and wider Europe in this. It's obviously a hugely important thing for everybody involved. People simply don't know enough, do they?
I really couldn't agree with you more as a journalist who spent 5 years working in Brussels for The Times. It's quite hard to get some of these, almost anything to do with the actual nitty-gritty and the detail of what's being debated in Brussels, partly because on a day-to-day basis it's rather boring talking about this directive or that directive, and it's quite hard to make that count when you've got a lot of noise coming out of Westminster about what they're doing. But of course, more and more things are decided in Brussels. I mean, all of this stuff was a bit of a mystery to me before I went there, and I worked in covering politics in London for several years before I went there. But again, I was rather ignorant. I just hadn't heard it anywhere. You never see an MEP on Question Time, for example. You may get Nigel Farage talking about that it's great to leave the European Union, and there would certainly be some things that would be benefits if you did leave. But you don't really hear much about the other side of the story.
All right, David. Well, the answer presumably is in the covers of the book Au Revoir Europe. For the time being, David Charter on the line from Berlin. Thank you very much for joining us on The Weekly. Up next, we'll be hearing about the London Art Fair. We'll be back in a second. The 25th edition of the London Art Fair has been taking place this week, and those still looking to pick up a painting can pop down to Islington today. But we're joined now by the fair's director, Jonathan Burton, to tell us how this year's event has reflected the best London art has to offer, and also, hopefully, why 2013 still has much more good things to come. Jonathan, thanks for coming and speaking to us on The Weekly.
Thank you very much for inviting
me. You should be welcoming people. You've taken time out. You should be welcoming people on the last day of the fair. How's it been? Has it been a good week?
Yes, so far so good. Good numbers of people coming through the door. Yeah. And I think, you know, interestingly seeing really sales across the board, both with the younger contemporary galleries, but the more blue chip players as well.
And this is the sort of balance that all art fairs need to get right, especially in such a sort of crowded fair marketplace.
Yeah.
Of getting the blue chip and getting the people through the door, getting the right sorts of people, getting the right buzz. It's a pretty tough balancing act.
And I think it's something that's sort of at the heart of London Art Fair. I think actually the range of work within the fair is very broad, and I think we try to look after, on the one hand, those Cork Street, Mayfair players showing sort of modern British art, the more expensive work, but also we're joined this year by you know, a large contingent from the East End, from South East London, from Peckham as well, that sort of younger contemporary spaces. And clearly what you hope is there's some cross-fertilisation, that sometimes the people who are collecting the modern work will also then become interested in the contemporary and vice versa.
And where do you sit in that spectrum? You know, London hosts a lot of art fairs. Where do you sit in that spectrum? What kind of customer are you after, and what kind of art do you and don't you find at the fair?
I think dealing with the last point first, I think what we don't sort of have within the fair is that tier of, you know, international contemporary work that you see at the major international sort of fairs. We don't really do that. You'll still see some sort of contemporary work. People like an artist like Jason Martin, who has an international reputation, and you would see at Frieze. But the predominantly is sort of, lesser known artists.
And does that mean that lots of the people buying from you are actually Londoners or British rather than in the international market?
Sure, I think it's definitely a London-focused show. And I think, you know, London is a kind of international city, and with so many people living and working here from abroad, perhaps people who have second homes, we would expect to come down to the fair. But what you see sort of mainly is that we have a very loyal base of well-informed visitors and collectors that come back each year, and I think have long-standing relationships with some of the galleries. So our sort of starting point is always to make sure that they do come back each year. But at the same time, one of the reasons that the galleries are obviously participating is to meet new people, and I think that's really across the board. So on the one hand, we're looking to bring in those high net worth individuals who have the means to be able to collect the more expensive modern British work, but you're also looking to those people who are perhaps more adventurous, interested in collecting edgier contemporary art, which where the sort of the price point is slightly lower.
And how do you organise the fair physically? How do you curate the space? It's at the Design Centre on Upper Street in Islington. It's a big old place, and it's at least two-tiered, isn't it?
Yep.
You mentioned galleries from Peckham. I guess you're referring to Hannah Barry as one of those.
Absolutely.
Galleries. She's quite a good person to have at the front, isn't she? She's interesting. They're kind of quite a cool crowd. Do you want to have people like that at the front of when people walk into the space? Or how do you kind of balance the Cork Street and the East End?
I think the main section of the fair, modern British and contemporary work, I think the focus there is that you kind of, as people come in, I mean, this year particularly, as you come into the fair, you've got some younger contemporary spaces on your right-hand side. Someone like Jack Bell showing contemporary African photography, joining the fair for the first time. And really our idea is that as people walk through the door, that range of galleries that they see immediately reflect the fair as a whole. So you've got younger contemporary dealers, but you've also got someone like the Fine Arts Society, a Bond Street gallery, showing both their modern and their contemporary work. But that's obviously the other end of the fair. Someone like Hannah Barry, very much anchoring our art project section, so a discrete section within the fair. This year with 31 galleries.
Discreet section. It's not a smoking room.
No. Discreet in the sense of being distinct. And I think, and really that's because I think people coming in looking for that style of work, those galleries want to group together. It gives them a critical mass. And it also means that those people who are interested in that kind of contemporary work know where to find it within the fair. But it's an interesting balancing act. You're right. You know, the building, on the one hand, is a huge advantage to us. It's a very beautiful building. But it's also a challenge because, you know, there's a perceived hierarchy that comes within that kind of within that kind of venue. The flip side is that, you know, you can go to fairs that are all on one level and it feels like you're wandering around a maze, and hopefully we don't quite have that.
Yes, at least you can look down from above and find where you are.
Yes, exactly.
Can I ask you quite a broader question, but goes on beyond your fair. Why do you think people buy art these days? The people coming through your door, I often look at people at art fairs and they're calculating, you know, is this going to be worth more money in 10 years' time or in 5 years' time or even a year's time these days? Is that the kind of person you meet at most fairs? You can't do anything about that? Or do you find that the people buying from you are looking for things that they want for the rest of their lives. And the other weird category, I always think that people looking for, you literally hear people having that kind of conversation. Will it go with my sofa?
Yeah, right, that. Yeah. Oh, that.
It's nice, but do you do it in a green?
Yeah.
They're my favourite sorts. They're every fair director's favourite collector, aren't they?
But what do you think of the buyers that come through your door?
I think the interesting thing is that people go to different fairs for different work. So I think that, you know, you may well go to an international fair because it's a very established contemporary artist and they see it as an investment. I think you do get people who will go to another fair and where they're buying purely from a decorative, you know, point of view, the kind of the does it go with my sofa kind of syndrome. I think what we see at London Art Fair is that people are well informed. They sort of do know what they're looking at. They're buying. We know that they attend a range of fairs. We know that they go both. It's interesting that they go to Frieze. You know, it's about 40%, I think, of our visitors go to Frieze. About the same also go to the Affordable Art Fair. And you realise that people really are dipping in and out of different parts of the market to sort of get for different reasons and for different work. But I think there's an interesting debate at the moment around sort of connoisseurship and really whether, you know, the move away from buying big flashy pieces and the sort of the one-upmanship, if you like, of owning a work by a particular artist, to actually kind of going back to something where people are looking for a slightly deeper emotional or intellectual relationship with the work. And I think that's actually quite healthy.
Finally, Jonathan, and I hope it's been a good 25th anniversary for you guys, but I feel that for the last few years maybe that the London Art Fair hasn't quite known what it was in the slipstream of the big kind of Frieze juggernaut, I guess. But it sounds like from your last response that it kind of that London Art Fair does know who it is, and it's for people that don't necessarily want to be seen at Frieze or want to be seen to be seen at Frieze, but they just want to buy some paintings, right? And there's less of a society aspect to it maybe, or an art world with a capital A and a capital W.
I think people are passionate about what they're collecting. I mean, I think you see people having, you know, the nature of the fair is that it's welcoming and inclusive, and I think the dealers approach the fair in that spirit as well. They want to have, you know, a serious conversation with the visitors coming through the door, and are prepared to take the time to do that. And I think that works clearly for the visitor, but it obviously works well for the dealer because there's the opportunity to either build on an existing relationship or hopefully meet some new people as well.
Have you bought anything this year?
Not yet. But actually, there's Pier, who are showing with us in Art Projects, have some really interesting additions, and there's a very beautiful photograph, so I may well kind of snap that up sort of before the end of the week.
And we'd encourage you to do the same. The London Art Fair is at Upper Street in Islington. Don't take your own red dots. They have them for you to stick on anything you might purchase. Jonathan Burton, director of the fair, thanks a lot for coming in.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Tully Kadar, a barista at Mecca Espresso in stunning Sydney, can't decide between the incredible warmth of the people and the outstanding beauty of the scenery when it comes to what makes life in Australia such a daily delight.
We have beautiful weather, a lovely culture, a unique sense of humour. Quality of life is just very high, and I'm very proud of the Aussie culture. I like our matter-of-factness. I feel like we have sort of a good balance between the outgoing, almost ostentatious American style and the very reserved British sensibility. I feel like we kind of land a healthy balance, and the culture's pretty cool.
There's nothing like Australia.
Having established the original model for urban transit and some might say frustrated commuters worldwide, celebrations are underway this year for the London Underground's 150th anniversary.
Our final guest, the design historian Mark Ovenden, will have had this date in his diary for a while, having written extensively about London Underground's international offspring, such as the Paris Metro and other transport systems whose designs make up some of the modern wonders of the world. His new book, London Underground by Design, goes back to the source to look at how an icon of the design world has evolved. He joins us in the studio now. Mark, thank you very much for coming on the Monocle Weekly. There's quite a few books coming out, I'm afraid, about the Tube. You've come in with a more kind of design angle, looking at what's happening happened over the whole history of the design. It's a really wonderful book. First things, one of the most extraordinary things, I think, even to this day, is the Tube poster. Now, we're going to talk about lots of elements, but the Tube poster, since the beginning, and looking back through your book, the examples from the 20s and 30s, somehow they've always managed to do well and produce incredible posters. Is that something that they have a team of people that runs? Are you aware of the kinds of talent that have come up through those posters?
Well, you're right. I mean, the aspects of design for something like a transit system for a big city like London are obviously multiple. You can go from the seat coverings to the ceramic tiles to the architecture. But when it comes to the posters, I think probably London was a little bit ahead of some of its other transit operators from around the world. For example, Frank Pick came to be involved in the publicity office in the early 1900s, and he realised that there was an opportunity to not just encourage more people to use the system in the off-peak times by telling them about the wonders of London, the zoos and the countryside and that kind of thing, but also to brighten up the system. I mean, these posters that came out in the early 1900s and after that were absolutely beautiful, almost iconic, as you're alluding to. And I think that they realised that they'd picked up on something which no one else was really doing. The mainline railways were doing this a little bit. There were travel posters in other parts of the world. But certainly the London Underground and some of the big mainline railway operators in the UK were beginning to understand the power of the poster.
And even today, I was just going to say, I still see some that I think have real charm today when you go down. You'd imagine that these days, when people are less concerned about kind of design, it seems, in some of the transport networks, that would have been forgotten. There still seems to be a heritage of design in some departments within London Underground to this day.
I think there was a period when it was perhaps slightly on the back boiler, actually, but they've certainly picked up on it again in the last 20, 30 years. And you can see classic posters now coming out of London Underground, which are on sale in things like the London Transport Museum, and they become, you know, popular favourites.
Yeah, it's an amazing thing. Why was design such a key part of the success of the Tube? Were the lines, I mean, I suppose, is it because the lines were in competition with each other and they wanted to attract people to here, there and everywhere? I mean, I'm looking here through your book and there's a wonderful poster called More For You. Who thought that through trains to the West End, stopping at High Barnet and Totteridge and Woodside Park, could look so beautiful? Do you know what I mean? And look like such a gorgeous piece of design. I guess this comes from the competition.
Well, yes. I mean, it was built as a series of private companies. And when the first big merger came again in the early 1900s, it was a time of great development for the Underground. That period between about 1908 and 1912, there were new lines opening. And the Underground Group, as we kind of know it today, was expanding. And the biggest competition then was the Metropolitan Line, which was a separate company, and a few other smaller ones. They had to try and establish what we now know today as a brand. There wasn't really the brand of the Underground, and they didn't really have a trademark. And I go into quite a bit of detail here, and you're right, there have been other books to talk about it as well, that traces how that brand was developed. Mm. The use of the large U at the beginning and the large D at the end.
And the roundel.
And the roundel, the development of the roundel, which is probably the best-known transit organisation sign in the world.
And so, the font that they chose, what did they choose? And again, it was a wise early decision, because it's the kind of thing that wayfinders would suggest now to companies, that you need to run it carefully across all of your elements and you need some kind of brand management of that. But again, they seem to have been a kind of early thinker about those ideas.
Possibly the first. You know, I mean, the font was commissioned 100 years ago this year by Frank Pick. It was finished around about 1915, 1916, and started going up just about the end of the First World War, 1917, and then was rolled out across the system. But it was a piece of foresight to say we need one font to unify this system. Because before there, and I give a few indications in the book, there are all kinds of sans serifs and serifs mixed up with hand-painted signs. Yeah. There's a lot of information to communicate if you're a transit operator. And it took other operators a long time to catch on. If you think about the New York subway, which now does look quite smart and it's quite easy to find your way around, it took them a long time. It took to the 1960s, really, to standardise the signage there. And even Paris, just across the water, who'd seen the development of a kind of unified font, they introduced theirs in 73. It was a sort of version of Universe. So it looked quite smart, but it took a lot more longer than that for them to really understand the power of good design.
And the branding of it seems phenomenally advanced. Metroland, John Betjeman's beautifully phoetic fawning over the Metropolitan Line was on the BBC last week, and it's a wonderful thing to which was offering sort of lush countryside views that would come past the sort of clattering trains, which is kind of the amazing thing. One of the lines he says, one of my favourite lines is he was lured by the lush brochure to Metroland. Was there proper literature that went with each individual tube line?
Absolutely, and some illustrated there, and many other books talk about it as well. And of course, the ultimate irony of Metroland was it was to move out of the cramped inner city areas and go out to the country and live in this beautiful area surrounded by fields and trees. But as soon as they built the houses, there were much less of them. So it was the ultimate irony of the building of the suburbs and the whole shape of London. In fact, most modern cities really is due to good public transport, because if you think about it, without a decent train service or even a bus, how do you get back into the centre where most people are working? So the kind of concept of suburbia almost really was born because of the way the underground grew.
Many of the best subway stations, underground stations, were built perhaps in the 30s and things. They're the ones that appeal to me most. They seem to be quite complete in how they're thought out. And especially when you get out of central London, they seem to be untampered with even now. I often feel sorry for some of the stations in central London where they've been added to over time. And, something like Tottenham Court Road now is going to be replaced, but it is perhaps one of the worst stations going. But when you look at all those stations, do you have a particular favourite?
For me personally, it's those wonderful Art Deco ones from the 30s you're talking about. The Arnos Groves, Austerlitz,
Park Royal, beautiful.
All those kind of, very, very impressive, very self-confident buildings.
Also, it was the first time actually that British architects and the only sort of successful way they ever really embraced modernism and deco and things other than the Express building was in tube stops, which is amazing.
And don't forget the Odeon cinemas that followed suit. I mean, all up and down this country, you can find people who borrowed ideas from each other in that fantastically decadent Art Deco period, and certainly Broadcasting House, or the Gaumonts, those kind of buildings were, they were loosely connected with each other, I think.
Do you think any of the contemporary stations will have that charm going forward?
Yeah, why not? I mean, you've got things like Southwark, which was built with a nod to the Holden and the Pick years and the Art Deco style, this kind of semicircular thing. And Canada Water, for example, is a complete circle as a homage to Arnos Grove. So, there are some.
And you've got Vauxhall that's straight out of Fritz Lang or something.
Well, there are some that may not stand the test of time.
Yeah, it's tough to pick a favourite, isn't it? But you've obviously done a lot of your research, not just by poring through old maps and things, but with a travel card in your pocket. Which is the most satisfying line to ride, and which is the most surprising end of the line destination?
Well, it depends on what you're looking for. I mean, if you want a speedy line that's going to get you where you want to go fast, then the Victoria line is pretty much second to none. Yeah. It's fast, it's got new signalling and new trains, and it works. The Piccadilly line, which includes some of those fabulous stations, is perhaps a bit more lumbering, God bless it, but they're working on it. And then if you want to go to the ends of, for example, the Central line, you'll end up in a funny little tunnel underneath Essex, where you've got these wonderful stations like Gants Hill, which was built to replicate a Moscow metro station. It's not quite the end of the line, but it's on the way. So, I mean, there's surprises all over the system, and anyone who has got a bit of spare time who's not just commuting to and from work and getting squashed into the carriages is definitely encouraged to go to the... Cock Foster's is another example, a fantastic train shed. It's very similar to the one at Uxbridge at the end of the line. Morden's very beautiful at the end of the line. So there are gems to be discovered, for sure.
But you mostly have to get out of town a bit to find them, right?
Well, you can find a few little ones around
South
town.
South Ken's got a nice sort of, it feels like a sort of rural sort of little station in Surrey or something.
I mean, don't forget all those ones like Covent Garden and Chalk Farm, the red tiling. I mean, that was incredibly inventive for its time to build a standard tile design all over London with these wonderful red-framed, red brick buildings. So, yeah, I mean, there's loads there, if you look.
Covent Garden, it's always a mistake to think you can go and walk up the stairs.
Yeah, exactly. Don't they do say that you shouldn't? There is a sign that warns you if you have a heart condition.
That always just tempts you to kind of do it. You think, I won't wait for that lift. I can do this.
Can't be that bad.
I know. then you're not even allowed to smoke on the second stair up. And what we should also address, we've talked about the success of the underground map, which is it must be the most iconic map in the world.
Oh, yeah.
But... lots of people obviously use it for above-ground navigation, which has its problems. There was a lot of politics involved in what was put where and how close things were to each other, wasn't there, in the early days? And I guess still, I mean, until it was
completely
standard.
The classic one is to try and get someone to go from Regent's Park to Great Portland Street via the Tube. they'll be doing for 20 minutes.
And they have and there was the urban myth of Piccadilly, the most expensive journey you could do in the world wasn't going on Concorde. It was pound per mile going from Leicester Square to Piccadilly.
And I guess it may have been shrugged off by more recent generations. But do you think one of the reasons that the London Underground became such a kind of an iconic institution and well-loved and obviously well-designed as because of the refuge it supplied during the war?
You imagine what it must have been like in any city that was bombed in the way that the cities in the Second World War were. It must have been so frightening. And for Londoners to have this extra resource to go down the steps, you know, even a few metres below ground, you could still hear them above your head, apparently, even when you were deep in the tunnels, you could still hear this distant thumping. But the fact that you were sort of mainly protected, some people did die in the air raid shelters, but the fact you were mainly protected must have really won the Underground to Londoners' hearts, I would imagine.
Before we go, we are going to have to say goodbye to Mark Evenden, but how great is the Overground as well, though?
Yeah, fantastic.
And that has a sort of, it doesn't have quite the same visual identity. The posters for the Overground seem to be few and far between. I guess maybe they don't need to promote it because people are just so relieved it's there.
I'm sure they're coming.
For the time being, Mark Evenden, author of London Underground by Design, the handsome book for a handsome project. Thank you so much for coming into
Thanks
the
Weekly.
Thanks
for having me.
And there we end it. 185 of those. Is it 185? I think it is.
That's a lot, isn't it?
It's a lot of Monocle Weeklies. Today's show, I really enjoyed today's show. Favourite guest? It's got to be the Underground Man.
Yes, I liked Mark. He was very nice and very enthusiastic about his book. We'll have him back, I think.
I think we will. And it's making me want to kind of nerd out, get a travel card myself and whiz up to the strange ends of Metroland, get out to Austerley, survey the concrete.
You're going to tell your driver he can go home alone today, are you?
take the afternoon off, James.
I'm going to go on the Underground.
Okay, on the Underground. Capital U, beautiful map.
I fancy an adventure.
Isn't it the nicest thing in the world, though?
Yeah,
I don't know whether I'd want to live. I don't know whether I'd want to live at the end of the line, but I kind of want to go there. It's quite nice to go on there for a little holiday. Right.
I would love to. It does make you want to go and see some of these stations. I'm still flicking the book. There's Southgate Station.
Southgate is beautiful.
It looks like a UFO.
It's amazing that. Southgate is a great station. I went there to watch the Church Times Cricket Cup final, and that happens in a big field in Southgate that was donated to the Church of England or something. And I'd never been to Southgate before, and you pop out, and it is this amazing suburban UFO, and it's quite cool. Look better perhaps under sort of gas lamps of the 30s than on a sort of summer's day.
Yeah, and the trouble is that there was always add-on kiosks and things these days. This is when it was opened and it looked naked and it's all its glory. It looks beautiful.
I think with the sentiment of naked and all its glory, Andrew Tuck, we should leave it there. Today's show was produced by Tom Hall. Our studio manager was Chris Fitch. Looking through the glass at us. We'll be back next week, but until then, it's good night. It's good night. It's turning into the two Ronnies. Until then, it's good night from me, and it's good night from him. Good night.